Featured guest today says the European Central Bank is at risk of failing, which could send interest rates soaring, outlines contingency plans for investors to shield their portfolios. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you give listeners today an idea of what they should expect, the World Economic Conference that you'll be holding?
Well, that one in Frankfurt is mainly just focusing for the our European clients. And our main one for the World Economic Conference will actually be in Orlando. That comes in November. In the States. The Frankfurt one is more of a seminar directed more at really the crisis that's developing in Europe, and that is the people don't realize. I mean, they keep hounding about the United States and oh, we have this debt and all this other kind of stuff, but the U.S. national debt, you know, at $18 trillion isn't really that much out of 150 plus, you know, trillion worldwide. And what they have to understand is that the biggest problem with the dollar and other currencies is if you go back to the Plaza Accord 1985 when they started G5, you know, that's where the U.S. told Europe, look, you need to create a single currency. We need something to compete against the dollar. They created the euro, but they never basically consolidated all the debts. And so they left everything still independent. And that's a problem because big institutional money still then has to look at Europe the same way they would look at the states in the U.S. You know, is it, you know, look at the credit ratings of California versus New York or Illinois, et cetera. So it's not just a single credit rating. So you have, you know, like the 10-year bonds going up and against the Italians and the Spanish, et cetera. So they never really created a single market as, beyond just the image of the currency. And then you have the central bank. And, you know, what has happened with this quantitative easing, Europe just went completely nuts. Draghi has been, you're putting people in these positions who have no experience whatsoever. You might as well put a cab driver involved. I mean, he goes in, okay, fine, we're going to increase money, put it into the system, but then they raise taxes. So, you know, this idea of quantitative easing, if I give you $100 and I say you give me 90 back, what did I give you, 100 or 10? You know, they don't look at it from a whole perspective. You put in all this money, I mean, even the U.S., you know, all this hype about, oh, we're going to see hyperinflation, etc. That assumes that the money is actually going into the economy and is going to stimulate and be spent by who? The consumer. All right? When you're giving it just to the bankers, you're assuming, you're hoping and praying the bankers might lend the money out, but they never did. All right? So then the bankers go back to the Fed and say, gee, you're buying up all the bonds. We don't have a place to put money. Oh, okay, fine. So then the Fed creates excess reserves. And then they put about $3 trillion in there. Okay, so how did the money actually stimulate anything? You bought the bonds, you gave the bankers the cash for the bonds, then they gave you the cash back and put it at the Fed, and the Fed then pays them 0.5% interest. They never lent the money out. So you have to pick up the rug when you're looking at this stuff. And, I mean, all the bashing of the Fed, etc., that is nothing in comparison to what's happened in Europe. In Europe, you know, the ECB bought in government bonds, but they've been doing this for nearly 10 years with no effect whatsoever. So what's, at this point in time, what's going on? The ECB owns 40% of all the national debts of all the EU countries, Eurozone countries. 40%. Now, what's going to happen when they stop? Who's going to buy it? There's no bid. All right, so interest rates are going to have to rise substantially before somebody's going to be willing to buy this stuff.
But we have a system that's been teetering since, you know, 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. The only thing holding the whole edifice up is negative interest rates. I mean, real interest rates. I mean, look at the PBOC, negative 3.75% for the overnight lending rate. EU, as you've already pointed to, first time in history, negative interest rates for their major banks. I mean, what happens if rates go up? Doesn't the whole Titanic flip?
Yeah, I mean, it has actually happened when you consider Europe. All right, with the ECB buying 40% of the debt. Now, first of all, what they're proposing, and it's part of why the euro's been rallying, and they've, you know, people don't understand what is actually at stake here. The proposal is that, oh, well, our problem is we don't have a euro bond, which is correct, all right? But Germany is against issuing a euro bond. So what they're doing is they're creating a derivative, which is exactly the same thing they did in 2007. Instead of putting mortgages in these things, they're putting the government bonds into them. So it's a mixture of bonds of Europe. And so they're attempting to bail out the ECB. Because as soon as rates go up, what's going to happen to the ECB's portfolio? Those bonds are going to crash. I mean, you're talking about really the Titanic here. And it's the only central bank that can actually fail. The Fed is like, you know, walking on water here. There's no way impossible. The Fed is in much better shape than any central bank in the world.
So really what you're saying is the EU, the ECB, really just a failed business model, economic model from the onset, was doomed because really you have a loose collaboration. There really isn't any unification between the peripheral states, the countries, if you will. And unlike the United States, which are united under one federal system, there really isn't a federal legal system in place. Will we see higher rates in the domestic United States following this implosion in the EU?
The Fed is also trapped. What you have to understand is that, you know, people, you know, you get a lot of people hating the dollar, etc. I probably get called into more governments than anybody else been around. But when I go to Washington, there are people beginning to realize that the U.S. as a reserve currency is a problem. And the problem is that you lose domestic policy objectives to international. So the Fed wanted to raise interest rates, and then you have emerging markets in Europe lobbying them. Say, oh, please don't do that because you're going to hurt us. So who is the Fed supposed to, you know, to deal with? Domestic economy or the international economy? This is the problem. The Fed has become the international central bank. Not intentionally, it's just the way it's happened. So the Fed should have been raising rates a lot sooner. All right. They waited to 2015 and then they said, look, we have to do this. The stock market's going up. I mean, if the stock market's going up, you're going to have effectively all the, you know, the Democrats yelling at them, oh, see, you're helping the rich with these low interest rates. We look at everything like a horse with blinders on, as if it's just the United States. So the Fed has no choice but to raise interest rates, otherwise it will be criticized by the Democrats for helping the rich. Then raising the interest rates when everybody else is negative, then that causes capital to come into the United States and sends the dollar up even higher and the stock market up even higher. So they're trapped. The same exact thing took place in 1927. The U.S. lowered interest rates. The central bank lowered the interest rates to try and help Europe. And they thought it would send the capital flows back to Europe. And it didn't. when they did that, people realized, wait a minute, the central bank is actually trying to do this? That means the trouble over here in Europe is much worse than we suspected. The capital moved this way. That's why, if you just look at the charts, the interest rates doubled. The Fed doubled the interest rates between 1927 and 1929, and the stock market doubled. This is the same thing happening again. And it's, you know, people, you know, don't understand about stock markets. They say, oh, it's going to crash and all this other kind of stuff. Again, they're only looking at this stuff with, you know, domestic, you know, blinders on. You know, if you look at the P.E. ratio, all right, they say, oh, the market's overvalued. Well, first of all, the P.E. ratio hit 50 at the top in the dot-com bubble. But where is the historical high? It's actually 2009. Reached almost 200. Why? And just ask yourself this question. If you think the banks you don't trust, you don't trust government, what are you going to do? Where do you put your money? They were buying blue chips. At least, okay, I know, I want to put my money someplace where I break even or close to it. It's not a question of, oh, gee, I'm going to earn 4% here versus 5%. You do reach a point where you just want your money back. It's called parking. Put that out. I mean, Barron's did an article, which I thought was funny, back in 2011. We came out, we said, look, the U.S. is going to make new highs. They did an article, didn't interview me. They wrote, oh, gee, Armstrong's calling for new highs. Like, ha, 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 like that's really going to happen. That was in 2011, all right? You get up to this point, I mean, I had someone else ask me for an interview, and I said, well, you know, what do you want to interview me about? And he said, you're the only guy that's been bullish. Everybody that comes on this show is negative. That's why the stock market keeps going up.
What will be the trigger point? I mean, obviously, there will be Time Magazine or Business Week will show, you know, Dow to infinity. You know, your Uber driver, not cabbie now, your Uber driver will have just made $1 million on Netflix or Google options. Okay, we know those signs. What will Martin Armstrong be watching for a top here, an ultimate, you know, zenith in U.S. equities?
It's basically capital flows. Back in 2011, we gave three targets on the Dow. Our first target was 18.5. We reached that. Okay. Our next one was 23,000, which we've been approaching. And then if we get through 23, we've been warning that then you get into what we call a phase transition. And a phase transition, to put it like in gold terms, 1976 gold fell to $100. By December 1979, it finally got to 400. All right? It went from 400 to 875 by January 21st. So you're looking at the last 6 weeks, all right, is what we call a phase transition, all right, a doubling effect in a very short period of time. That's what we're looking for in the Dow. When you see that, you know, it will probably get through 23,000, and then you're going to be looking at the high 30s to like 40 to 42. When you see all these bears that are out there, which I think is more than 90%, when they finally flip, I mean, imagine, you know, I wrote, this is the most hated bull market in history. The whole bull market from the and during the 1920s, all right, was 97 months. So at month 97, Shoeshine Boys are buying it. This is it. We've reached a permanent plateau. We reached 97 months this past April. Where are they? They're still bearish.
I still get emails regularly here from subscribers, listeners who say, you know, I was so burned by 2008, 2009 stock market crash. I can never even look at a market ticker again. What about the fact the middle class has been decimated? We've lost close to 5 million official high-paying manufacturing jobs outsourced. The middle class is wiped out. And, of course, the upper elite are happy days here again, blue skies. How important is that? Because right now the Fed just released a report showing 44% of Americans have not a single dollar in savings for an emergency. I think it was 75% have less than $500 to $1,000 in savings. If the middle class is not participating in the market rally, how might that change the character of this rally and the ultimate crash that follows?
Well, what you're looking at is capital inflows. And that's really what's behind a lot of it. That we're not looking at, you know, the average person running out and you know, buying equities per se. But you're looking at more of a situation where, you know, we're the prettiest of the three ugly sisters, you know, as they say, from Asia and Europe. And Europe, I mean, if we're looking at a very serious situation developing in Europe, the smart money has no place to go but here. And you just look at it this way. The U.S. was bankrupt in 1896. All right, that's when J.P. Morgan had to lend $100 million in gold to the U.S. Treasury to bail it out, etc. We go from 1896 to 1945. After two world wars, the U.S. ends up with 76% of the world's gold reserves. Why? Because Europe is blowing itself up. Smart money moves. All right? It all came to the United States. If that hadn't happened, we'd still be mostly farmers. Farming was 40% of society in 1900. It was 70% in 1850. So, the jobs, what we're, you know, people have to realize and that, you know, we're also going through this age of really technology advancements. I mean, the Great Depression, what made it great was actually innovation. When the combustion engine, once that came into play, you had development, it moved into tractors by 1920, et cetera. So that displaced a lot of jobs. That's why unemployment went to 25%, because agriculture was 40% of the civil workforce. So the combustion engine wiped out most of these farmers. They're the ones that became the hobos. So, you know, World War II came into play, and these people then were, you know, put into war, etc., to give them employment. They didn't have the skill set. And this is the same problem we have going on right now. And as technology advances, we don't necessarily need the manufacturing so much, or service jobs. Service jobs are getting really hammered. And, you know, they don't understand, you know, these politicians we put into play. Oh, it sounds nice. Oh, we should double the minimum wage. These poor people don't have anything to live on. No, that's not the answer. The answer is basically to teach them a skill. And because what happens is you raise the minimum wage, and when what happens? You then have Obamacare putting all kinds of burdens of regulatory and benefits, etc. So you get, you know, stores, Wawa's and 7-Elevens and McDonald's, whatever. They can replace these people very easily with a little screen. You go in, you pick what you want, that's it, comes out the back.
The CEO of Carl's Jr. just called for all his stores in the next few years to go fully automated. You swipe your card.
You go to the Frankfurt Airport in Germany. It's the most advanced I've seen anywhere. There's nobody there behind the counter. You go to check in, you put your passport in the machine, out comes your boarding pass. You then take your bag over, you put it on a scale, all right? It then weighs it, it puts out the, you know, the tag, you put it on the thing, and off it goes.
The Ethereum model so impressed IBM and a few other major companies. This is, of course, the cryptocurrency Ethereum. What they did is take Ethereum and take a washing machine. The washing machine used Ethereum to call the repair person when the machine broke down and pay the repair person and then order new parts.
Just go to Starbucks and stand in line and you'll see everybody that's probably under 30, maybe even, you know, mid-20s, whatever, they just hold up their phone and pay. All right. People talk about gold is money. Okay. To these people, not even paper is money. I mean, things are changing. And so it's substantially different. It's not universal income. It's more or less that you have to really, if you, you know, the old saying, you know, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach him how to fish, you feed him for a life. That's really what has to happen. But it is often the older generation, which are the people from the manufacturing, etc., that do not adapt and do not move forward and retrain themselves. And so they become antiquated within the system. And that's the problem. And so this occurs all the time. And there are waves of innovation. And when the railroad happened, Sears, you know, which is going down now, but Sears was one of the first mail order companies. You'll see old Western movies where, you know, people went to the general store and they ordered something and then it came by train. Train was basically the internet back then. It was the Amazon. You could order it and it would be delivered. All right, so it wasn't as efficient as Amazon is today, but the same principle. So it's innovation takes place always with technology. The technology may slightly change, but the basic principle is always the same. So you had the trains create the wave of innovation in the 19th century. Then you had the combustion engine. Then you had airplanes. And basically, then you had computers. And, you know, the dot-com bubble was a big thing. But, you know, people see the future, but then they run away with it too fast. So then the dot-com, you know, crashes and burns. But, I mean, our own company, I get so often, because we tend to be opposite. We're the biggest institutional advisor in the world. Why? Because we used to deliver our reports by Western Union in the late 70s. And if we would cover a market and we would send out 3 reports on that market per day as it was trading, and it was $50 a piece if you were, like, overseas to get, you know, so you're talking about $150 per day to get 3 telexes. Then, effectively, most of our clients could only be institutions because the communication costs were like $200,000 to $250,000 a year. And a retail person couldn't possibly afford that. That's where we started opening up offices overseas so we could, you know, deliver one telex to there, and then that would redistribute, bring the cost down for people. Then faxes came. Okay, now we go from $50 to $3. All right, now the internet's here. Okay, and we have over 600,000 people at this stage in the game. So it gets to be, you know, it's interesting, but technology has changed our firm. And we can, you know, we have our own computer system that we've been a forerunner in developing for years. I mean, so we have, we use artificial intelligence. We basically created, I began in programming myself. So I had programming skills and trading skills. So I basically wrote a program years ago that taught the computer how to do this. And so now we have a system, Socrates, and I mean, you can go to our website and see it. It's armstrongeconomics.com. But I mean, the computer actually writes all the forecasting reports. And it's covering every market in the world. And the one thing that is great about it, we're one of the few companies that's not blocked in China. Why? Because the government knows what we're doing. They know in paragraph 3, we're not slipping in a little line, oh, by the way, overthrow your government. They know it's all written by a computer. So we're one of the few people that are basically not blocked in China. And governments rely upon us all the time because it's not biased. It's a computer that's doing it, and it's very black and white. That's it. Simple as that. And we all have opinions, but you can't forecast markets from opinions. I mean, maybe you'll be right one time. Maybe you will be wrong the next time. I mean, this computer basically was the only thing that legitimately forecast that Trump would win, Brit exit, that Spain, you know, that Catalonia would vote to separate. I mean, it's done every election. It came out and even said that Le Pen would beat all the mainstream parties in France. So you can't do this from an opinion perspective. The computer's looking at absolutely everything. You can go on our site and look. We've posted charts. When you look at the politics from a market perspective, all right, how many seats? We have a chart we put on there. How many seats do Democrats and Republicans hold combined between the Senate and Congress, all right? The Democrats peaked with the first election of FDR. Ever since, they've been making lower highs and lower lows. It's been a bear market all along. All right, people just don't quite get that, you know, they get caught up in the fundamental nonsense. And the basic trend has been down. Why? Because we put it very bluntly. This is the collapse of socialism. This is the West's turn, all right? China and Russia went through the collapse of communism. This is still the same problem. Socialism and communism, what do they have in common? Centralized government planning. All right? Communism, they own your house. Under socialism, you own your house, but the government taxes the hell out of you for it, and it tells you what you can do and cannot do. All right, so it's still centrally controlled. All right, and that doesn't work because a politician never understands anything. And I can tell you, I mean, I've been called into so many different governments around the world and Brady commissions and back for the 85, G5 formation and stuff. And I can give you one conclusion that I have discovered, I think. And that is you can walk into Congress and say, if you do not do this, 20 million people will die tomorrow. And you know what they'll say? Maybe you'll be wrong. All right. Think of it this way. If I were to run for president and I say, vote for me because I saved your job, the first thing you're going to ask is that, how did I know I was going to lose it? All right? You just, BSing me or what's going on? It's much better for a crisis to happen. You lose your job. Then I run and I say, vote for me. I'll get the guy that did it. Government never prevents anything. All right, I've been called into everything from the Reagan administration on down, and I've learned it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Republicans, Democrats, all the same thing. Just show me the money. That's what it comes down to. I was called in to help, supposedly privatize Social Security back when the Dow was 1,000. I show them how to do this, set this up. Okay, fine. Democrats killed it. Why? Because they said, no, we want to be able to change the managers when we get into power. And I said, this has got nothing to do with, putting your brother-in-law in. I don't care if somebody has the best track record, that's where we go. All right? I don't ask them, who did you vote for? It's nonsense. I mean, Hong Kong, when Hong Kong was being turned over to China, all right, I had the mandate to try and buy property from Australia. I met with the Australian government. There was an island offshore of I said, look, I'll buy this island. Hong Kong wants to move down here. No, we can't give sovereignty. So then I said, okay, fine, give us the upper left corner of Australia. They'll come down here, okay, fine, you don't have to give us sovereignty, but it's its own state. And still denied. I met with the finance minister at the time, was Paul Keating, who became prime minister, all right? And I said, what is it? I have a blank check to write here. I could pay off the national debt of your country. You know what he said to me? I thought it was racist. He says, no. He says, it's not racist. He says, they're not labor people. They were afraid that if all these people came in, that they would vote conservative and the labor government would be out of power. They only look at themselves. I could have paid off the national debt of Australia. I had to go back to Hong Kong and say, very sorry, I can't do it.
I'd like your thoughts, though, on precious metals. I mean, obviously, if you think U.S. equities are headed possibly much higher, do you see more trouble ahead for the precious metals, or will they catch some of the uptrend along with equities?
Eventually, the precious metals will turn up, and they will turn up with equities. Because at that point in time, what you're looking at, some individuals will look at buying the metals as a safe haven. The big money will be looking at buying equities. Talking about pension funds and stuff like that. They can't buy, you know, 1 ounce coins or bars or stuff like that. They need to earn income. They can buy gold stocks, but they can't buy bullion. So they will eventually both move up together. But in order to do that, that's when we cross that threshold, and suddenly everybody wakes up and says, "Oh my God, what's going to happen here in Europe or Asia?" And then you move all the capital into the U.S. You're looking at just parking. That's when gold will take off. It's not, you know, this hyperinflation, oh, they increase the money supply, this. Look, that, you know, you only get to a real bull market when people question who's going to survive. And that's what you have to look for. As far as money supply and increasing this and all that kind of nonsense, it doesn't mean anything because you're not looking at the real full picture. All right? I mean, Bitcoin took off like heck. Why? Because over 90% of them were in China. They were just using it to take money out of the country. And the Chinese were buying up all the property in the United States and Canada, et cetera, like the Japanese were back in the 90s. All right, it's you look at a lot of Chinese, and they didn't trust their government. I'm gonna get some money out before something happens, and that's what they were doing, using for Bitcoin.
Okay, last question: is there a tropical port of call in Europe you'll be vacationing in after the big Frankfurt conference?
No, I have meetings. All right, well, take care. Thank you for inviting me.